Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. First, a moment of remembrance. It was in August 13, 1982, 33 years ago, that the stock market took off, a wild celebration of the political victory of neoliberalism and the recovery of the profit rate. We've been living with it ever since. Two guests today. First, in just a minute, the economist William Darity will talk about the shortcomings of Bernie Sanders' economic proposals and how they might be done better. And the blogger R.L. Stevens II talks about Black Lives Matter and the problematic creation of a leadership class. First, William Darity, also known as Sandy. Darity is professor of public policy at Duke. Much of his academic work is focused on stratification, inequality, and racial discrimination. He's a longtime advocate of making the federal government the employer of last resort and giving every newborn a government-financed trust fund to reduce wealth inequality. He's been in the news lately criticizing the weakness of Bernie Sanders' economic program. William Darity. You have some thoughts on Bernie Sanders' job creations proposals?
Yes. I think that, you know, my primary thought is that it's simply not ambitious enough. In fact, it doesn't strike me that his youth training program is very different from the premises behind the Manpower Development and Training Act, or the manpower development philosophy itself, which is, I think, predicated on the view that the reason why many people are jobless is because they lack the skills that are desired. And my perspective is that joblessness is primarily attributable to a combination of the absence of a sheer number of adequate work opportunities, but also in the case of workers from particular groups, like the Black community, because they're subjected to discrimination.
Now, this is both a structural and a cyclical issue, right? Because we recovered significantly from the Great Recession, but there's still a lot of ground to recover. A lot of people untouched, but even in the best of times, there are a lot of people who are untouched by prosperity. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think that that's reinforced by the evidence that, you know, consistently the unemployment rate for Black Americans is about two times as high as the unemployment rate for white Americans. But moreover, that ratio also holds at every level of educational attainment. And in fact, whites who have not completed high school actually have a lower unemployment rate than Blacks who have completed some college.
What do you attribute that to? Is it discrimination or is there more at work?
I think that the differential in unemployment rates is a very pure index of the degree of discrimination in the economy.
And then, of course, then you have the issue of wage levels, right? Even otherwise identical people, there's a wage gap of 10% or so?
Right. So you've got, you know, you've got first the question of discrimination and access to jobs, and then after jobs are obtained, there still can be discrimination in wages.
What could be done about that?
Well, unless we had a mechanism for satisfactorily enforcing anti-discrimination measures, I think the only other significant option is to provide people with the opportunity for work regardless of their age, race, status, et cetera, assuming that they're adults. And I've been a long-time advocate of having the federal government function as what some people refer to as an employer of last resort. That is to say that the federal government would provide a guarantee of employment for all Americans who are adults, and that guarantee would apply universally, so that it would exist on a permanent basis, so that anyone who is seeking work can be assured of finding a work opportunity through a public sector employment opportunity.
Employers might not like that very much, right? That would increase workers' bargaining power and tend to bid up wages.
It would actually effectively function as a true minimum wage or minimum wage standard, because presumably employers in the private sector would have to at least match the minimum compensation that's provided in the public sector. On the other hand, this structure of employment opportunities could provide a vehicle for a wide range of human and physical infrastructure improvements that would actually be beneficial to the private sector. We wouldn't be able to transport goods and services as efficiently if we didn't have a well-developed interstate highway system. And that interstate highway system, significant portions of it were constructed in the 1930s under the auspices of the Works Progress Administration and the Civilian Conservation Corps, which are programs and projects that are very similar to what I have in mind. So there would be an infrastructural cost benefit to the private sector. And also, it would be possible to have some sort of arrangement where workers who were working for the public sector might also have assignments on a basis of shared cost with some private sector employers.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what sorts of jobs and sectors did you have in mind? You're suggesting working highways and such, and infrastructure building. That would be appropriate for mostly youngish men, but there are other people who also need work.
Right. So if we go back to the Works Progress Administration, a very concerted effort was made to match the types of skills and abilities that individuals had with the kinds of work assignments that they were given that were, you know, presumably going to be beneficial to the community as a whole. So I'm also thinking that there could be an opportunity to build or rebuild or build new schools through the use of the public sector employment. We could also train people to provide high-quality daycare so that it would expand the opportunities for other folks to actually work without having to worry about the well-being of their children in the meantime. We could actually provide opportunities in the way that the WPA did for folks who are artists and performers, to form troupes or studio teams within the context of the public sector employment program and provide performances or artistic works that would be associated with the infrastructural products that were being designed by other members of the of that workforce.
And have you worked out what kind of financing requirements? How much would this cost?
We have estimated in some of the work that we've done that if we were to provide non-poverty wages for all participants in the public sector employment program, which would mean an annual wage rate of at least $23,000 plus benefits, including the same type of health insurance program that our current public sector employees have, that the mean cost of hiring any individual worker, including the materials that they would have to work with, would be about $50,000. And if you put 15 million people to work, which was the number of folks who were out of work at the worst point of the most recent recession, then the program would cost about $750 billion per annum. And that's in some sense, a worst-case scenario, because that's the number of people who would have been seeking jobs, presumably, at the trough of the current or the most recent recession. But $750 billion is approximately equal to the entire cost of our various anti-poverty programs. So essentially, it would be an offset. We could substantially reduce the anti-poverty programs, and we could expand this type of program, which would have two effects. It would function as a way of eliminating poverty in the United States, and also eliminating joblessness.
The Polish economist Michał Kolecki had a famous essay about the political problems of full employment in which he said in this regime of full employment, the sack would lose its sting and there would be loss of discipline in the factories. And the employer class would not like this at all. Was that wrong, or how would you manage that anxiety among the employers?
I think the employer class will not be entirely happy with this proposal, but, you know, I'm suggesting that there are some potential benefits to them. But, you know, presumably the employer class is an outvoted minority. I mean, unless we're truly a plutocracy, where it doesn't really matter what any of us think unless we have a lot of money, there's some occasions in which some segments of the population are going to have to eat their dissatisfaction. If it's better for the vast majority of the people who comprise this society. So Kolecki's not incorrect. It's just that it's a matter of whose interests really are going to be represented by the national government. And so I think this is a case where we have to bring the proposal to the people and see what happens.
I'm sitting with William Darity, who's a professor at Duke University. Now, instead of this kind of massive jobs program, a lot of people on both the left and even the libertarian right have proposed a universal basic income, some kind of minimum income without a employment requirement. What do you think of that?
So I'm not opposed to that. I mean, I think it's philosophically, it's fairly consistent with the central objective of this program, which is to effectively eliminate poverty. On the other hand, I think there's a wide range of tasks that would be socially useful that are not going to be provided by the private sector because they may be perceived as being unprofitable. And so that there's a double benefit of having a program of this type. But I don't have any principled opposition to having a basic guaranteed income as long as it was an income sufficient to prevent people from being in poverty.
Going back to the Sanders question, most of what he proposes, it doesn't really have a specifically racial angle. It's not, it doesn't, whether out of political caution or a personal preference, he seems to prefer very broad, universal, non-racially distinctive proposals. Do you think that's enough to solve the kind of discrimination disparities you were talking about earlier?
Well, the proposal that I've mentioned is a universal program, so it's not race-specific. The question is whether or not programs of this type might disproportionately benefit the most deprived members of the society. And I think that there's some sense in which the very smaller scale Sanders program might have a disproportionate benefit for black youth. But the program that I have in mind clearly would be beneficial to the folks who are most likely to be excluded from employment. And to the extent that those are black Americans, then there probably would be a disproportionate benefit there. But it's a universal program. Any American would have the opportunity or option of taking the employment that's provided by the public sector under the kind of proposal I have in mind. Where I think there's a real lacuna in the Sanders program, and one that's somewhat surprising to me, given his general interest and desire to address the problem of inequality, is the absence of any type of initiative that aims at addressing wealth inequality in the U.S.
You anticipated my next question. So why is that important?
Well, I think that wealth, as opposed to income, is the most significant indicator of family or individual well-being. I mean, it's via wealth, net worth, the difference between our assets and our debts, that we're able to provide ourselves with protection against emergencies. We're able to provide ourselves with the opportunity to purchase high-quality education. And given the fact that money seems to matter in the political process, wealth provides you with an avenue to be a more effective participant in the political process. It gives you resources that can be passed on to the next generation, either while you're living or after you pass. So I think wealth is a critical dimension, and to the extent that we have huge disparities in wealth, consequently we have huge disparities in people's opportunities to participate fully in American life. So it strikes me that that's an area where a major policy initiative would be of great value. And, you know, I was hopeful that the Sanders campaign might develop a program of action in that area, particularly since it is a campaign that's placed a great deal of emphasis on the problem of inequality.
Now, just to take the measure of that, if you take, for example, two households, one black, one white, at the same income level, the black household is likely to have only a fraction of the wealth that the white one has. Is that correct?
That's correct. If you were to look at the median household that's white, I think approximately in the 2011 estimates that are available, the median white household would have approximately $120,000 to $130,000 in net worth, and the median black household would have less than $8,000 in net worth. And if we were to compare households by educational attainment, and this is a really, really disturbing statistic, and perhaps one of the most dramatic that I can offer. Blacks who have completed college, that is, blacks with a college degree, have $10,000 less in net worth than whites who never finished high school. So these racial disparities are enormous. But I would also say that the disparities within ethnic and racial groups, whether white or black, are also substantial as well. So wealth inequality is perhaps, I think, one of our most critical national issues.
And what could be done about it?
Well, so in addition to the proposal for a federal job guarantee, I've been a longtime advocate with Derek Hamilton at the New School of something that we refer to after Manning Marable's suggestion as a baby bonds proposal. Now, this is not literally a bond. It's actually the provision of an endowment or a trust for each newborn infant in the United States. This trust fund would be calibrated on the basis of the wealth position of the infant's family. So, if Oprah Winfrey or Bill Gates had a new child, then we'd give them a $50 trust fund. But for children born into families at the lowest end of the wealth distribution, we'd give them a $50,000 or $60,000 trust fund. If the mean fund amount was about $20,000, then if there are 4 million kids born each year, the program would cost about $80 billion, which from the standpoint of the total federal budget is not really that much. And we would not allow young people to access this fund until after they reached adulthood, so 18 years of age. So the very first cohort to actually receive funds would not do so until they reach their 18th birthday, which would provide the government with a substantial opportunity to build up a reservoir of resources to meet these needs. So, I think that the notion of giving every young person in America an asset foundation is the best way to address the kinds of inequalities that exist. I mean, this is not going to eliminate wealth inequality, but it certainly would mitigate it and kind of change and dramatically change the opportunity structure in our society.
And perhaps finance with a wealth tax to chip away at the top?
Yeah, there are folks who've talked about altering the tax structure so that we could finance such a program, but I think it could be financed even if you didn't do that.
That was William Darity, professor of public policy at Duke. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the first movement of the Fourth String Quartet by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by the Sorrel Quartet. Next, R.L. Stevens II. Stevens is the founding editor of Orchestrated Pulse, which you can find at orchestratedpulse.com, a blog about politics with an emphasis on race. Stevens has an excellent long essay on the blog called Dear Black Lives Matter, We Don't Need Black Leadership, that criticizes a line of thinking that is very popular these days. As he says in the piece, making certain black people, even if they're queer and are women, the face of a new black leadership class will not save black people. The problem with the black leadership class of old isn't that it was male, it's that it was elite and used to control the masses. The same dynamics are at play today. Stevens has an extended analysis, which we only touch on in this interview, of Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party of the 1960s. It was explicitly multiracial. As Stevens also writes, Fannie Lou Hamer didn't go to the 64 convention demanding, as some Black Lives Matter activists do today, that black leadership be foregrounded. As she stared down the Democratic Party and their allies in the national black leadership class, she did so as a member of a grassroots political party intimately connected with the needs of poor people in Mississippi. It has always been the centering of participatory politics, not the elevation of black leadership, that has been truly threatening to white elites. That's why a concerted effort was made to destroy Fannie Lou and the MFDP, and within 10 years, their form of participatory political organizing had been all but extinguished. I urge everyone to read this essay. And now here's R.L. Stevens II. So, Black Lives Matter, we've been hearing a lot about black leadership, the importance of following black leadership. There's always a question of selecting which black leadership to follow, but that's another issue separately. But what's your problem with this call to accept black leadership or follow black leadership?
Well, I think we have to look at it historically, and that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to look at what has been the role over time of a black leadership class. Now, don't get it twisted. You know, I don't want people to misinterpret my position. It's not that I'm saying that we shouldn't have black people who have leadership skill. What I'm saying is that there's a problem with the leadership class. One of the things that is really interesting about this campaign, I'm not saying this out of loyalty to the Sanders campaign or concern for that per se. It's more about how there's been a representative claim being staked out here that a certain element has put out, a certain segment of Black Lives Matter. And there's a certain segment, as you were saying, that is staking their argument around the notion of black leadership. Not black leadership skill, but a black leadership class. What's making me make that conclusion is, and why I brought this up in the article, is that they're articulating features of the people who have started Black Lives Matter, for example. The features. These are queer black women. These are queer black women. These are queer black women. That's about a qualification for the leader, for membership in this new leadership class. They want to make them the face of a new leadership class rather than to talk about any specific skill or any specific strategy, tactic, or analysis that is salient to this new moment. And so that, to me, suggests that something's going on here that may have stronger parallels, not to say Lou Hamer's tactics and her intervention in the white political space, but it might be a little more similar to indirect rule and to the emergence of leadership classes that have been always been a conservative feature of black politics and have been much easier to manipulate. What Hillary Clinton did in Boston, that happened after I'd written the article. She handled it perfectly. She separated a few protesters out when they tried to come and interrupt her. She brought, I believe, five into the room, and then she dictated the terms of the meeting. They refused to detail anything that she said, so she's allowed to then control the narrative, pretty much. That's a leadership class. She's creating a break, even within the protesters' group themselves, a break between certain privileged representatives and the group as a whole. And that I think, is the dynamic we're seeing at play. It's kind of split between those who claim authority to speak on behalf of black people and the actual lives of black people and black masses, and that there's no actual direct political connection between the people who are staking their authority to speak on blackness as leaders and the day-to-day suffering of black people who are actually going through police brutality, who are actually going through poverty and whatnot. And I'm not just saying that rhetorically. Like, this is something that I've lived. You know, I don't have a fancy job or anything like that. I actually work at a low-wage retail store. And where I was working, all the sales associates were black, and all the managers were white. So we were in this really polarized racial situation. And I was trying to organize at the job. And Black Lives Matter never once came up. The people in the store, poor people, didn't have the ability to, like, go to a lot of these events. And it was not a relevant aspect of their lives. But what was relevant was the fact that we had on-call shifts, or we weren't being paid any money, or any number of these types of direct economic pressures were things that we were talking about organizing around. And that dynamic, that kind of gap between the rhetoric that's being discussed and the authority that people are appealing to and the actual lived experiences on the ground, that gap has been a persistent thing that's been emerging since Ferguson. And that's a huge problem, in my opinion.
We've seen over the last year or two in the emergence of Black Lives Matter a familiar mechanism, even if it's a different cast of characters. You get politicians, media, foundation officers who recognize a leadership class, and then suddenly they get anointed as the spokespeople for an entire group of people. It has different qualities now. As you said, they're queer black women and not straight black men as they were in the civil rights days. But the mechanism seems not unfamiliar, the way what Hillary did nominating a certain group of people as leaders and speaking with them. Is this what you're getting at?
Yeah, it's a management process. It's a management strategy. And that it goes, like I said in the article, it goes back to colonialism. It goes back to indirect rule. Because there's one of the fundamental assumptions of Black Lives Matter is that white people don't care about black people. And that's just not historically true. White people are obsessed with black people, actually. Black people and white people are intimately connected, and that it's about control and power, and that they will allow, especially in a post-integration setting, but even during the colonial period, they will allow certain token black people to advance their interests. They love black leadership, the class. Actually, a class of black leaders, because it makes it easier for them to control the black masses. And we've seen that over and over and over again. Bill O'Reilly loves a black leadership class. And we all remember when Don Lemon got up and said, you know, hey, racism would be over if black people just pull up their pants. But the reason why he said that is because he was saying that Bill O'Reilly was right. And he was responding to Bill O'Reilly's call back over the summer, I believe, of 2013, for black leaders to step up. And he wasn't talking about black people with leadership skill. He was talking about the class of black leaders need to step up and advance his conservative agenda. And that's been the historical role that this class has played. It's not that everybody in the class is bad or that they're all, you know, colluding intentionally. That's why I had the quote from the historians, from the Genoveses, saying that it's a complex social system that successfully redirects anger and resistance from the subjugated masses into safe channels. That's what happens. It's not that people are bad or they're stupid or anything like that. It's that the system is extremely complex and the people that control it are cunning and we can be. I think Samuel Hamer was a genius. And the things that the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party were doing were genius. But there's a complex system that will destroy it. And that's what happened to Fannie Lou and the MFDP. People forget that Fannie Lou felt completely forgotten and abandoned at the time she died in the 70s. There was a concerted effort to eliminate her and her movement, not simply because she was a black woman, but because of the form of politics, the insurgent, participatory politics that she actually represented. And when I say actually represented, I don't mean that it was just rhetoric that she was putting out. She wasn't at the convention trying to be heard. that's not what it was in general, you know, just trying to be heard, trying to have a conversation, which seems to be what a lot of the activists are saying today, at least publicly, that they want this conversation. She wasn't doing that. She was trying to legitimize her form of politics where she had an actual political base developed over years of canvassing, of voter registration, of community forums, local conventions, and she was an elected representative of that actual black, poor black political constituency. And she was trying to get enough seats to make them the only legitimate representative of the Democratic Party's national organization. That's what she was doing. It was a power move tied to people's specific lives and tied to specific demands. What's happening right now is because there is no actual political bloc of black people that most of us can speak on behalf of for real. Like, even when I'm talking to you right now, I recognize that I'm not speaking to you right now on behalf of an organized political bloc of black people. That's not what's happening. But I'm not claiming to. I'm trying to talk to you about how can we develop strategies, how can we develop analysis and tactics to build those blocks so that we can have a coalition that might be successful. Because where I'm at in my thinking right now is that we're in a period where everybody agrees, and this goes back to Barbara Fields' concepts around race ideology. People genuinely believe, and this is what the Sanders thing really, this is why it really bothers me. They genuinely believe that the only way to reach black people is with big neon signs that say, black issue, and that all other people, especially white people, are these nuanced thinkers that have various political interests, and you can appeal to, you know, there are all these different things. You don't take white issue and put it out there unless it's something like, Mexicans are coming, get rid of them. That's the neon, you know, white issue. That's how they do that. But that's not the only way that they engage a white electorate or a white political base.
I'm speaking with R.L. Stevens II, who is the founding editor of the blog Orchestrated Pulse. You were saying earlier that you were mentioning the way that Fannie Lou Hamer organized, very traditional, old-fashioned way. And I think a lot of the partisans of Black Lives Matter see this as a new model of organization, much more spontaneous and, by their claims, leaderless. What do you think of that strategy as a newer way of doing things in this, you know, Twitter-dominated age?
I first cut my teeth during Occupy, and there were very obvious limitations to that particular tactic long term. And number two, you can't actually have a completely leaderless situation. There are going to be times when you have to have, for example, someone who signs checks. And because we didn't have a democratic way of facilitating that, there was money that was stolen. We didn't have redundancies in place. We didn't have, we weren't organized. That's what I learned through that period, is that you do need to be organized. And here's the thing. It's about building power, and building power in an ethical and democratic fashion. And in order to do that, you have to have real tactics and strategy. So, for example, like, the rich white men that really benefited from the Revolutionary War didn't go out and, like, for example, with the Stamp Act, which disproportionately affected them, you had to pay a tax on documents and stuff, and rich white dudes are the ones who had all the documents, you know? They didn't get out and say, hey, rich white male lives matter. That's not how they organized. They created a strategy where they made an appeal to no taxation without representation and the values and principles of liberal democracy. By doing that, that created space for subjugated peoples, of whether it be white poor people who were a huge segment that had interests that were in direct conflict with the rich white people advancing the revolution rhetoric, or even black people like Crispus Attucks, who was the first person to die in the Boston Massacre, and as a result of a lot of this rhetoric, they were able to build a broad multi-sector coalition that was ultimately something that disproportionately benefited this new national elite, right? This minority, actually, the rich white men that for advanced this American Revolution were a minority living in a society that was hostile to their interests. And yet they created a platform, they created a strategy that got a broad section of people of different identities to advance something that disproportionately benefited them. And I'm saying that we should learn from that. When we're in a situation where thousands of non-black people, for example, are killed by the police over the past few years, if we're trying to deal with police brutality, we have to create a way of dealing with it that doesn't make it a race-only issue. Because when you make it a race-only issue, then that plays into the hands of this dynamic around creating a black leadership class that's able to manage this particular niche market, in this case, the black masses, resistance. And then you're going to create a ultimately conservative and isolated political movement. And we're seeing that start to happen. Just yesterday, that white teenager, I forget his name, that was killed, his parents were on, I believe it was CNN, and the interviewer asked them if they thought their son's death would be more widely covered if they were black. And this question, it stoked a resentment, a white racial backlash to police brutality as a public issue, because they were like, yeah, it would get better coverage. And then now you have a situation where you're pitting these people against each other rather than on the same issue, on an issue that they have in common, where their kids are being killed by state power arbitrarily, something which they should be completely united around. But because of the way that this is being framed, it's being framed in a way that narrows the interests and doesn't allow for broad coalitions, you have a situation that the media class and ultimately the people who control the society can exploit in order to stifle the movement and make it less possible for there to be success. And that really bothers me, because the only payouts that we're really seeing right now, and I mentioned this in the article, we're seeing the rise of certain stars. In the article, I quote someone who says that the Ferguson protesters more broadly resent this kind of star system that's being created, where a few privileged people, and he mentioned D-Ray and Netta, for example, are receiving foundation funding. They're getting money to go around to all these different protests around the country. And I actually experienced this firsthand. So when people think that I'm just against black leadership and I'm just hating or something, it's because I've seen it up close. I've seen what's happening up close. And it's not this, like, master conspiracy. It's just how the system works. And so when I went to Baltimore the day after the riots happened, right? And I went there to hand out food and to really get a chance to move through the streets with people and to see where they're at and to try to help. Try to help with what the conversation was, what was going to be the next step, right? And when I was there, when I first got there, people were afraid. We met at a church, and they were afraid to go out into the community. They wanted everybody to come to the church and get food. Well, that just tactically was not going to work. I wasn't going to be able to go out into the neighborhood and be like, follow me, random stranger, back to this place. Yeah, no, this is Baltimore. People die here. Like, it's not a game. That wasn't working. So it took a long time for I and a few other people to convince the church leadership to let us take the food out into the community. And that was good, and it was working. Eventually, Meta came to the church, actually. So I was like, oh, and here's one of the most famous Ferguson protesters. This is cool. Like, what's going to happen now? And people on the ground there were excited. They wanted leadership. They wanted, but not a celebrity, but leadership skill to help us learn how to deliver food and to the community and build support for people who are struggling and suffering out here. Being in Baltimore that day was a life-changing experience. It was, the suffering and brutality and just deprivation in that city is unreal. And it's something that I had never seen before. And so I was like, this, we need to organize. And the people want it. Something needs to happen. But when Netta got there, she didn't hand out any food. She didn't pick up any bags. She didn't do anything. And her role was to be a member of this new leadership class and to make an appearance. And there was no ultimate work that was being produced here in this space. with people who needed encouragement and help, not just some sort of appearance, but actual tactical knowledge being shared and actually talking about how do we canvass the neighborhood? How do we do this? And what are we going to do next? These are questions that needed to be put out there, that we needed to be organized. That's leadership skill. And that wasn't what was being facilitated. And about a week later, that's when the New York Times spread came out about her and D-Ray, both of whom I saw in Baltimore that day, but who weren't actually trying to make any organic connections with the people on the ground. I couldn't believe that. And I couldn't believe that this is what is being advanced in both media, and that's the organizational model. It is to react to the death of a poor black person and get in the news cycle and then move to the next story. That's a problem to me.
I'm speaking with R.L. Stevens II, who is the founding editor of the blog Orchestrated Pulse. The mass incarceration, police violence, really emerged from like the deepest structural recesses of American society. It's got, you know, so much to it that why we suffer from this kind of organized state violence and repression. Is it, you know, a movement organized around hashtags? Is that going to be able to challenge those deep structures in any meaningful way?
It's possible. I don't know. I don't have the answers on, you know, how this is absolutely going to go down. What I do know is that it's going to take an organized flock of people. It's going to take a multi-sector effort. Black people are a minority in this country. That's just the reality. And as I said, not all black people are united around these issues. And we don't all want the same thing. We're going to have to actually organize and build political solidarity, not just amongst black people, but within the country as a whole. And what are the strategies and tactics that are necessary to do that? Because right now, there's a disproportionate reliance upon empathy, and I'd say guilt, for especially white guilt. What they're doing is going after low-hanging white fruit and then using the controversy from those types of clashes to legitimize their presence in social media and media more broadly. But none of this is actually advancing a political bloc. That's why it's different than Fannie Lou Hamer, who was intimately connected to not only a specific mass of poor black people and poor people more generally in Mississippi, and that's why she was doing what she was doing, but also she had a tactics and a strategy for why she was in that space, and she had specific demands that she was trying to achieve. And that's eventually what we're going to have to do. And I don't see this particular stuff as building towards that, because that's not what happened in Baltimore, and that's not what happened in Ferguson. You know, 120 people, I think, have been murdered in Baltimore since Freddie Gray died. But these people who are out talking about Black Lives Matter, and, you know, these are, especially I remember when Dear White People came out, and they said that black-on-black crime was just a myth. The only people that really talk like that are people who aren't living in spaces where black people are being snuffed out on the daily, where violence, black violence from black people is a proximate reality. For example, even if we got rid of all people in prison for drug offenses, even if we got rid of that, we'd still have a huge number of prisoners. Because the reality here is that violence is part of our community, not just black communities, but communities more broadly. And so to deny that reality, to me, that suggests the classist nature of a lot of this racial discussion right now, especially under the Black Lives Matter banner. Because a lot of the people talking are people that have a background like me, middle-class black people who are college-educated. And so there hasn't been an admission that, hey, police brutality affects us differently, and I can't just speak on behalf of all black people's experiences and take this issue up as if it's representative of my day-to-day experience, when it's not necessarily, or at least it might be situationally. And yeah, we're all at risk in an elevated way in comparison to white people, but we need to have a class analysis that recognizes that it's poverty, really, that's driving a lot of these experiences for people. And that's something that we can actually unite around. And I'm not seeing that happen. That has potential. That's not even, I don't want to be dismissive and say, oh, you have a hashtag, you can't do anything, you're never gonna build anything real. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I'm not seeing anything that suggests an organic, intimate connection with poor people, poor Black people in particular. I'm not seeing organizing happen. And so there's some that's happening. There are different organizations that are wrestling with the same issues that I'm talking about. What's happening is that amongst this emerging leadership class, that is not the conversation that's happening. That's not the work that's happening. At least that's not what they're talking about. And that, to me, is the problem. That's what makes it so far removed from the lived experiences of people on the ground. Because you have these people who get up and say, as what happens with Dear White People, for example, and say things that are obviously false, that are ahistorical claims, that are just wrong. Like the protester that interrupted Bernie Sanders, as well as the Black woman who got the job for being his campaign spokesperson, both of them have been advancing this idea that racial injustice and economic injustice are parallel issues. That is patently false. That is ahistorical, and that is just wrong. Are we not supposed to talk about that? Are we not supposed to deal with that? That's what I'm struggling with. I'm saying that these are the emerging voices, and that's really all that we're getting right now, because the demand is for a conversation. So that's all I have to engage with, is what is the nature of this conversation? You have these emerging voices saying things that are patently wrong, and doing so in ways that benefit disproportionately the Clinton campaign. That's what this conversation is doing. And so I don't understand why this is something that we can't discuss, why we have to pretend like this is leading somewhere other than more jobs, more funding for people united under this particular banner, and therefore will rise, their interests will rise and further dislocate them and disconnect them from the Black masses. That's ultimately what this is. I can't co-sign that. When the rhetoric was going around about how there's no Black-on-Black violence and that's just a distraction or whatever, I was talking to one of my friends, and her brother, who had been shot before, he's been shot multiple times, but her brother, this is in the south side of Chicago, was just shot and paralyzed from the neck down. And this is something she hadn't even anticipated. She always knew, because he was in the streets, she always knew that he could die or he could go to prison. But she never thought about him being paralyzed. And this crushed her and her entire family. This is a real thing. He was shot in front of his mom, you know? And this is real. And his mom had to go outside and be like, hey, don't kill my son. Stare down the gunman. This is what's happening out here. So to have rhetoric so divorced from it, that own self-serving rhetoric at that, that only serves to as media fodder, you know, that's what's happening. And I can't take it. You know, it hurts to see, because our people are dying. Not only are you not going to represent at least, or at least talk openly about really organizing, not only are things like Ferguson going to happen, where a leadership class emerges and then they leave the masses behind to be broke and suffering. Not only is that going to happen, but you're going to promulgate rhetoric that is patently false and in no way connects to the lived experiences of our people who are dying, and in no meaningful way can be used to build politics that could actually win. That is what makes me so upset about what's happening right now.
All right, I got to stop it there.
Let me say one last thing. Do you mind?
Okay, go ahead.
Now, I'm not saying any of this to talk down to anybody or to say that anyone's stupid. That's not what I'm saying. When I first started writing it and when I first started participating in activism, I was sloppy. I was a sloppy thinker. I didn't know what I was doing. And I relied too much on intuition and didn't have a strong enough mastery of like theory and history. And people pointed that out. I did some good when I was in this sloppy mode of thinking and organizing. Despite despite my weaknesses, you know. But people are dying and good isn't good enough. You know, we've got to be great, especially because of the historical moment in which we're embedded, as well as just the wanton savagery of the enemy that we're trying to face. These things demand greatness, and we've all got a long way to go, and we have to start by being honest about what's happening and being honest to the fact that we can be complicit in things that actually end up hurting our interests. And that's what I want people to understand.
That was R.L. Stevens II, founding editor of the blog Orchestrated Pulse. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the second of five preludes for piano by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. Till next week, bye.